Chapter 54. Yet another residency. My career was moving right along. I was about to embark on my second 11-month Weaver in Residence gig, this time at the Wollongong Institute of Advanced Education. The institute was a teacher training facility that was partway through the process of amalgamating with the University of Wollongong, conveniently located right next door. On campus, I was allocated a demountable building, situated beside a busy walkway. The building had a portico entrance, with a storeroom behind it, and a large carpeted space, with windows on two sides. To draw attention to the building, and create interest in the activities that would take place within its walls for the duration of the residency, I made large multicolored posters for each window, facing the walkway, with catchy wording such as, "Make art, not war." What is a weaver in residence? Why do we need one? Come in and find out. And, warped or weft? Responses to my open studio promotion strategy were immediate, with students, staff, and the community beating a path to my door to talk about textiles, discuss their work or view the finished pieces I had brought with me from Goulburn. At my request, the blackboard wall was covered with cane eyed sheeting to create a super-sized pin board for attaching work in progress, as well as displaying finished work. As part of the residency package, I was given a no-frills four-shaft counterbalance loom that was more than adequate for the work I planned to produce at the beginning of my stint at the Institute. I'd kick off by weaving a wall-hung triptych, each panel representing one of the three most spectacular physical aspects of the Illawarra: the mountains, the steelworks, and the ocean. On my first day, I was befriended by longtime Institute Arts Administrator Peter Shepherd and theatre lecturer Gary Stonehouse, who, like me, was a newbie. His position had been created as part of the Institute's recently launched performance and theatre degree course. Over my time in Wollongong, we three became regular diners at the university's staff restaurant, and before long we all had extra kilos to show for it. Part of my job was to support the Institute's textile department, that was run by a long-time teacher educator, who I sensed was somewhat overwhelmed at the prospect of her skills-based textile subject area being offered as part of a degree course. I did what I could, but it was obvious that additional hands-on help was needed. Someone with broad textile experience to assist through the transition. A part-time position was on offer to begin with, that would ultimately become a full-time lectureship. Maybe I could help? My newish friend, fellow weaver, Liz Jenade, seemed the perfect fit, as she was an early childhood teacher, who, with crafts board support, taught weaving in her Sydney studio, and also played the guitar. I made the initial introductions, and Liz applied. She was successful and stayed for 20 years. But I digress. In amongst the hectic startup energy that hovered over the Institute that year, Liz and I found time to attend a 5-day intensive workshop with Sheila Hicks at the Craft Centre Gallery, located at the end of George Street, in Sydney. It was a magnificent space that had once been the Seamen's Chapel. The centre's director was an innovative thinker who had the idea to invite this world-famous American fibre artist to come to Sydney to produce a series of artworks with the help of a handful of local textile artists. Liz and I were two of 13 artists invited to participate in what turned out to be an extraordinary experience in the company of the who's who of Sydney's textile art scene at the time. To be honest, I was quite surprised to be included, but I took it in my stride. At Hicks's request, bales of laundered fabric were sourced from Sydney's hospitals and elsewhere to be used for a series of monumental artworks designed to fill the enormous Craft Centre Gallery space. After brief introductions, we began work, each of us assigned a job. I remember volunteering to paint the glass of a window, located very close to the ceiling, because the light coming through it into the space was distracting. A scissor lift was used to hoist me up to window height, holding a tin of white paint, and a brush in one hand, and hanging on tightly to the basket rail with the other. Working with Sheila Hicks to create the Craft Center installation was an eye-opener. What I learned at her workshop would influence my work into the future, particularly the touring exhibitions that were yet to come. At the beginning of the Wollongong residency, I returned home to Goulburn on weekends, because I desperately missed my dog. But I returned less and less, as the pressure built to produce an exhibition for the Wollongong Art Gallery, to coincide with the end of my residency. Occasionally, Peter dropped in to visit me, on his way to Sydney, for business meetings with Peter Clyde, a notorious disbarred barrister, who lived in some style, at the Siebel Townhouse Hotel, and offered bankruptcy advice for $1,000 per consultation. But, to quote Job of the Old Testament, trouble came. It may have been the quantity of fried food I'd consumed at the university staff restaurant, or the emotional distress I was experiencing, as the gulf widened between Peter and myself. Whatever the catalyst, I became very ill. I consulted a naturopath, who ordered a strict vegetarian regimen, and mega minerals with no fried food or alcohol. Somehow, I managed to go to work each day, but I was completely devoid of the inspiration needed to come up with a convincing concept for the exhibition that would mark the completion of my residency. I was truly terrified as the deadline drew ever closer. The creative breakthrough came about as the result of a strange sequence of events. I'd wound a warp of fine natural linen thread, then dyed it in patches of mulberry and dark chocolate brown. My plan was to weave across it to see what patterns, if any, emerged. This was a crude attempt at Ecart weaving. As I dressed the loom, the individual threads kept breaking, so I had no choice but to abandon the project. But not being one to discard disasters, I stored the 10-meter-long warp for a future project. Late one quiet Saturday morning, whilst working in my studio, I decided to wind a narrow warp with a thicker linen thread. I then dressed the loom, with the intention of using the discarded warp as weft. I clearly remember checking my watch, as I was poised to begin this experimental piece. It was 1 o'clock. The next time I checked it was 4 o'clock and I had zero memory of the time in between. Looking down at the strange piece I'd woven, I was transfixed. Where had this piece come from? I tried to stay calm, as I was petrified I was losing my sanity. I quickly removed the piece from the loom, and pinned it to the K-night wall before fleeing the studio. On the way back to my flat, I called in on a newly acquired friend to debrief. As it turned out, this was unwise because, ever after, she gave me a very wide berth, possibly concerned I was possessed, or crazy, or both. Around this time, students from the Goulburn Primary School gifted me tens of meters of multicolored tubular French knitting. I decided to use the thick knitted thread across a narrow multicolored woolen warp. I also included lengths of pastel colored ribbons, saved from the packs of tea towels used for the Australiana range. The result was an unexpectedly powerful totemic triptych. As my health returned, I became more and more excited by the possibilities my unexplainable Saturday afternoon zone out offered me. The magical piece produced that afternoon heralded a completely new direction in my work. Each of the pieces that followed was strongly influenced by the sights and sounds of my adolescence spent in New Guinea. One of the pieces comprised 9 handmade felt squares, manipulated and stitched. Another had bird feathers woven into a pure silk warp, with linen weft. Another had short lengths of bamboo woven into a linen warp. All captured the spirit of the New Guinea Highlands. That the New Guinea Highlands popped out as the subject of this series came as a surprise. We'd lived there for many years, but until now, I was unaware that the essence of the country had seeped into my being. When all the artworks were completed, I arranged them on large chipboard panels, covered with beige sheeting, stretched taut. The Morley Granger Wollongong, 1982 exhibition, launched with great fanfare. The opening was well attended, and feedback from gallery patrons was extremely positive. As a result, the art gallery director was happy, the institute boss was happy, and so was I. Before I embarked on my next adventure, that would take my textile skills into deepest, darkest Queensland, out of the blue came another prestigious tutoring gig. I was flattered to be invited by the World Education Fellowship to tutor in textiles, at their annual 10-day workshop, held over Christmas, at the prestigious Frensham School at Mittagong, an hour or so from Goulburn. It was at this workshop that my circle of artists and craftspeople grew exponentially. I met many talented people, who were destined to become very well known, both in Australia and overseas. For example, glass artist Warren Langley, third-generation wood carver Lorenz Otto, and paper artist Kathy Nix. Out of class time, a group of tutors set up the Hotel California on the first floor veranda, off their rooms. This became an after-hours magnet for tutors and students alike, with the exuberant sculptor, Frederick Chapeau, the ringmaster. My next stop was Toowoomba, Queensland. On reflection, the Sheila Hicks Workshop. My lasting impression of the workshop was the scale of the pieces we helped to create. As hand-picked participants, we were the lackeys, who were occasionally consulted, as the installation progressed. I'd describe the scale of Sheila Hicks's commission work, made both before and after our Sydney workshop, as monumental. Whereas, the word I feel best describes the scale of my work is domestic. This description is fitting, because in the early days of the Morley Granger studio in Goulburn, I was using my art training in combination with sewing and weaving skills to make pieces to sell, the size governed by the demands of the market and the cost of production. Interestingly, the domestic scale carried through to the textile artworks for all 10 thematic exhibitions I went on to make. Alcohol. Midway through my Wollongong stint, I sipped on the last alcoholic beverage to ever pass my lips. As I recall, it was a couple of glasses of cheap champagne. Up until that evening, alcohol had only been an occasional indulgence for me. Deciding to quit for good was a very smart decision to make, both for the sake of my health and my finances into the future. The Wollongong Art Gallery. The gallery director was quick to inform me I was the first contemporary Australian textile artist invited to exhibit in his gallery. This disclosure was made after he'd checked out my work, to make sure it was suitable. I was chuffed to prime the pump, leading the way for contemporary textile artists to exhibit their work there in the future. The art-craft divide. The late 1970s brought rumblings of dissatisfaction from some artisans who were endeavoring to step away from the craft classification of their work. This was because many weavers, potters, jewelers, or glassmakers considered their one-off pieces as art. I've always considered my exhibition work art because each piece is unique, and therefore impossible to duplicate, in part due to the limitations created by working with recycled textiles. French knitting. Carnival Lay is a stunning three-piece artwork made using meters of French knitting. Unexpected gifts of this kind are a godsend, because they stimulate my creative process. When the Morley Granger Wollongong 1982 exhibition was over, I presented Carnival Lay to the Goulburn Primary School. The French knitters were thrilled to see their knitting incorporated into an artwork, and the piece was given pride of place somewhere in the school. Facts. Sheila Hicks. Sheila Hicks is a leading 20th century avant-garde textile artist, who turned weaving into a three-dimensional art form and, shock horror, encouraged viewers to touch her work. She uses fabrics and fibers to weave, knit, knot and braid. Warp and weft. Warp and weft are the two basic components needed to turn thread or yarn into fabric. The lengthwise or warp yarns are held in tension on a frame or loom, whilst the widthwise or transverse weft, sometimes called the woof, yarn is drawn through or inserted over and under the warp threads. Ecart. A technically exacting method used to create a pattern in hand-woven cloth. White warp threads are carefully wrapped in sections and then dyed, with the wrapping excluding the dye. When the threads are dry, the wrapping is removed, the loom is then warped and weaving can begin. Patterns created can be simple or more complicated. French knitting is a form of knitting that uses a spool with a number of nails or metal loops around the rim to produce a narrow tube of fabric. A cable needle or crochet hook is needed to make each stitch. It's a labor-intensive technique used to create a knitted tube that can be used in many ways. The New Guinea Highlands. My mother moved to the Highlands to introduce a hand textile industry. I visited regularly between 1964 and 1973, my visits giving me the opportunity to absorb the colors of the country and the culture of the inhabitants. I've come to realize our time in the Highlands was a great privilege, and from the experience came the artworks for the Morley Granger Wollongong 1982 exhibition.